on behalf of my fellow directors and colleagues at the Federalist Society. Please accept our greetings, as well as deep appreciation for your participation in this year's National Convention. We've been coming together here at the Mayflower Hotel once each year for this conference since 1987. We come together to learn, to debate, to see old friends and colleagues who share our principles, and to build friendships and alliances too. But there is another reason we take 3 days away from our homes and our offices to be here in the Capitol: to make sure that there is a bright, vibrant flame that will continue to light the route to limited constitutional government. Thank you for being here to help kindle and carry that flame. Our opening speaker, Senator Mike Lee, has helped carry this flame along the way, going back to law school days when he presided over the Federalist Society's BYU chapter. Now, you are all quite familiar with Senator Lee's background, but please allow me to offer a couple of observations regarding more recent events in his public life. Trying and uncertain times test the true mettle of a man. We all, at some point in our lives, have witnessed this firsthand. As the tumultuous events of the past couple of months unfolded here in the nation's capital, this simple truth reached center stage. The government shutdown drama unfolded each passing day with accusations of impracticality, recklessness, and conceit being hurled to and fro. I could not help but be reminded of Robert Bolt's most wonderful play, A Man for All Seasons. In one exchange, King Henry's Lord Chancellor, Cardinal Wolsey, tries to convince Sir Thomas More to opt for the pragmatic, convenient, and advantageous options in political matters, admonishing More that, and I quote, "Your conscience is your own affair, but you are a statesman." Sir Thomas More would have none of it. He fires back at Wolsey, "I think that when statesmen forsake their own private conscience for the sake of their public duties, they lead their country by a short route to chaos." It is my humbling and joyful privilege to present a United States Senator, a fellow Federalist, who was fearlessly searching for a route back to our Constitution of limited government. Senator, it may be a long and perilous route in an age of political expediency, but I hope you will always consider the Federalist Society a brief rest stop along the way where you can refresh and refuel. Mike Lee, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Leonard, and thanks to all of you for being here and for giving me this invitation to speak to you today. I was speaking to my wife last night, who was in Utah. She asked me what I was most looking forward to today, and I said, well, the Federalist Society, naturally, these are my people. I love this organization. It's been a part of my life for most of my life and virtually all of my professional career, and it's a real honor to be with you today. The topic for this year's convention is textualism and the role of judges. We all know the important role that the federal judiciary serves within our constitutional system. And we're blessed to have an independent judiciary that's staffed with judges who seek to uphold the law consistent with their oath to faithfully and impartially discharge and perform their duties under the Constitution. And I'm, of course, a very strong proponent of textualism. You see, textualism is the principle that ensures that we live under the rule of law, that persons subject to laws that inevitably restrict their liberty are able to know beforehand what the law is. When judges read into statutory text some kind of purpose or some kind of change, some kind of alteration to the statutory text, they tend to impose new laws on the public. The public does not have a notice of judicially created laws until after the case or controversy in question is decided and the opinion in question has been rendered and made public. And even then, the public's in a bad position because the public may have no confidence that the law won't change again tomorrow. More to the same point, they have no ability to remove the judge or justice in question once that law has been changed, once the policy has been modified. You see, with good reason, we have elections for those who make our laws. We don't have elections, at least not in the federal system, thankfully, for those who interpret them as judges. This, among other reasons, confirms my view that textualism is the only method by which a judge may properly discharge her duties, consistent with the Constitution. The Constitution vests the lawmaking power in Congress and not the judiciary, and departures from textualism often, I would say inevitably, lead to judicial lawmaking, which tends to threaten the Constitution's carefully established system of separation of powers. And so even with respect to the judiciary, especially with respect to the judiciary, we must be vigilant to respect separation of powers. And we do that within the judicial branch through textualism. But it's also through textualism that we do that within the other branches, or at least we should. It's with respect to the broader issue of separation of powers and some of the threats to this fundamental structure within our constitutional system that I wish to direct my remarks today. The current presidential administration has, I believe, violated the Constitution's separation of powers in numerous and in some cases completely unprecedented ways. The president has obstructed legitimate legislative oversight, as for example, when he improperly asserted executive privilege in response to inquiries from congressional committees in connection with the Fast and Furious investigation. He has refused to enforce the laws that he does not like, as for example, he did when he issued an executive order effectively suspending the operation of certain immigration laws, announcing that he would selectively enforce those immigration laws in a manner that essentially assumes into existence a legislative proposal that Congress, within the last few years, has considered and resoundingly rejected. He has made unprecedented and unconstitutional recess appointments at a time when the United States Senate was not in recess, and he sought to immunize his expansive executive agenda by seeking confirmation of additional unnecessary judges to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. I want to say a few words about these last two abuses of power, which have particular relevance to the judiciary and which have particular relevance to my work in the United States Senate. The D.C. Circuit is, of course, among the most important federal appellate courts in the country. Many would say second only to the Supreme Court. But it's also, right now, one of the least busy. And I don't mean to suggest that the judges are over there wasting time. It's just that, for whatever reason, the caseload is not particularly high on the D.C. Circuit right now. And for this reason, both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have agreed, albeit at different times, that that not every seat in the D.C. Circuit should be filled. In fact, in 2006, a group of Democratic senators sent a letter strongly arguing against filling any of the seats on the D.C. Circuit. That letter stated that an additional nominee to the D.C. Circuit, quote, should under no circumstances be considered, much less confirmed, before we first address the very need for that judgeship, close quote. Now, in 2006, based on the court's caseload at that time, Democrats refused to consider the nomination of my friend Peter Keisler, a nominee to that court whose qualifications and whose integrity, whose abilities, whose judgment need no defense in this audience. Since that time, the D.C. Circuit's caseload has actually decreased, not increased. As Senator Chuck Grassley recently pointed out, under the most relevant metric of caseload, appeals filed and appeals terminated. The D.C. Circuit is the least busy court of appeals in the entire country. In fact, in both categories, the D.C. Circuit is less than half of a national average. No one familiar with that court and its caseload would sensibly, credibly suggest today that the court is in need of even one additional judge. And in response to an inquiry sent by Senator Grassley recently, one member of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, who shall go unnamed, stated, if any more judges were added now, there wouldn't be enough work to go around. And that's saying something. Doesn't happen very often within federal offices. Nevertheless, and even after earlier this year we confirmed Sri Srinivasan to the D.C. Circuit, President Obama is seeking to add three additional judges to the D.C. Circuit. There's little secret as to the president's intentions for taking this step. Of the D.C. Circuit's eight active judges currently serving on that court, four were nominated by Democratic presidents, and the other four were nominated by Republican presidents. And with President Obama's expansive legislative agenda stalled in Congress, President Obama has sought unilaterally to impose his initiatives on the American people by means of executive orders. These executive actions, in many instances, are quite appropriately reviewed in the D.C. Circuit. And so, in the words of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrats want to switch the majority. The Senate has thus far held strong and must continue to do so. Earlier this week, we stopped yet another of these nominees from being confirmed. This administration's threat to separation of powers is real, and any attempt to make the courts complicit in that threat must be repelled, and that's one of the reasons we're taking this step. As this audience well knows, the Constitution plainly places in the Senate the duty, the responsibility, and the right to consent to the president's nominees, his judicial nominees, and his executive nominees. The only exceptions to this rule apply with respect to certain inferior executive officers not at issue here, and of course with respect to certain appointments made during a recess of the Senate. As to this latter exception, the Constitution provides certain constraints. Recess appointments may be made only to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate. That's in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 3. I should also note here that the Constitution expressly grants to Congress, to each House of Congress, the power to determine the rules of its own proceedings. The Supreme Court has explained repeatedly that this is a power that lies within each body of Congress. It's not for the courts to decide what rules would be best. And although the court has acknowledged that neither House of Congress may, by its rules, ignore restraints or violate fundamental constitutional rights, within these limitations, all matters of method are open to interpretation of the House, and it is no impeachment of the rule to say that some other way would be better, more accurate, or even more just. Now, between December 17, 2011, and January 23, 2012, the Senate held regularly scheduled pro forma sessions of the Senate every 3 days, at which it could, and in some cases did, conduct legislative business. For example, at the December 23, 2011 session, the Senate passed H.R. 3765 to extend the payroll tax holiday. Nevertheless, one day after the United States Senate opened its second session of the 112th Congress, that occurred on January 3rd, 2012. One day after that, on January 4th, 2012, the president invoked the recess appointment power to nominate four individuals to executive branch positions, three within the National Labor Relations Board, and one, Richard Cordray, to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. 24 hours after the last session of the Senate was held, 24 hours after the very first session of the second big picture, capital S session of the Senate had convened for the first time. And so this was a very significant moment where the president had invoked the recess appointment power. To be clear, in previous decades, various presidents of both political parties had invoked the recess appointment power. But it's important to remember that no president had done anything close to what happened here. No president had ever made a recess appointment during a two-day intra-session recess, nor had any president presumed the authority to tell the Senate when it was in recess. These appointments were truly unprecedented, and they were truly unconstitutional. In attempting to justify these rather alarming recess appointments, the president relied on a memorandum prepared by the Office of Legal Counsel within the Department of Justice. That memorandum chiefly relied on a prior opinion rendered by the executive branch, which had taken a predictably broad view of the executive's power to make these kinds of appointments. That opinion, which was rendered in 1921 by Attorney General Harry Doherty, eschewed the plain text and original meaning of the recess appointments clause and instead gave what it called a practical construction of the clause, asserting that the touchstone for determining when the session is or is not in session for purposes relevant to the recess appointments clause is, quote, its practical effect, viz., whether or not the Senate is capable of exercising its constitutional function of advising and consenting to executive nominations. Ironically, even under this quote-unquote practical construction of the Constitution, President Obama's recess appointments were patently unconstitutional. The Senate was, in fact, conducting business during pro forma sessions. The NLRB nominees had been advanced only about 2 weeks before they were recess appointed, and the Senate had already rejected the president's nominee to head the CFPB. So the president was not facing a situation in which the Senate was unavailable. Rather, he was facing a situation in which the Senate, exercising its constitutional duty and its utilizing its constitutional right, had chosen, in one case at least, to reject the president's nominee, and in other cases, it just had not chosen to confirm nominees yet. This is very, very different than being unavailable, and in any event, the unavailability standard, while I'm sure that was fun for Attorney General Harry Doherty to write in 1921, was not even satisfied here. The president thus made recess appointments to circumvent the Senate. And in that process, to circumvent the Constitution's structure, he circumvented important protections, limitations on his power that prevent and protect us from tyranny. Now, I will now summarize what it is that the Senate did in response to this. I'm going to summarize for you all of the things that the Senate did to stand up for its own institutional prerogatives as a Senate, which is very interesting. And that's the end of that part of my speech. You see, we didn't do anything. We just sat back. I mean, we were even more feckless in that moment than the proverbial English bobby who, being unarmed upon seeing the commission of a crime, says, stop, or also say stop again. We did absolutely nothing. We have to do something when that happens. So judges are not the only officers within our constitutional system who take an oath, to uphold and protect and defend the Constitution. Members of Congress also take an oath as required by Article 6 of the Constitution. We take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. In my mind, to defend the Constitution means, at a minimum, we don't take actions that violate the Constitution. But I think it also means that we do take actions where necessary to prevent the abuse of the Constitution, where we see it being violated by others. Our Constitution envisions a separation of government powers to ensure checks and balances. As Madison explained in Federalist 51, the great security against the gradual concentration of the several powers within the same department or branch consists of giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachment of the others. Among these necessary constitutional means is the Constitution itself. As Madison explained elsewhere, each branch must, in the exercise of its functions, be guided by the text of the Constitution according to its own interpretation of it. According to its own interpretation is an important part of this. We've lost sight of this in recent decades, with Congress deferring excessively to the courts, with Congress refusing over and over again to undertake any independent constitutional analysis. It is as though we've outsourced this function, not to India, but to the Supreme Court, and we've said we can't have any part of that. That's their job, that's their constitution, they're in charge of that. And so at this moment, when this arose, you actually had members of the United States Senate who, when asked, what are you going to do about it? They responded basically with the statement that, well, we'll let the courts iron it out from there. We'll let the courts worry about it. I don't think that's enough. I didn't think that was enough then. And although I was ridiculed for it in the national media and in my local media in Utah, I decided I had to do something. The only thing that I could think of to do that was proportional and well within my powers as a United States Senate, as a United States Senator, was to no longer continue to vote for the president's judicial nominees, which I had previously voted overwhelmingly to confirm. And so between the unconstitutional recess appointments on January 4, 2012, and the time that we finally invoked the Leahy-Thurmond rule in the summer of 2012, I stopped voting for President Obama's judicial nominees as an indication that I, for one, was not going to simply ignore the fact that he had openly thwarted the Constitution. A lot of people said I was crazy at the time. A lot of people said, well, the courts aren't even going to agree with you. Look, regardless of how the courts of appeals had handled this, I would have felt good about what I did. It was necessary. But I'm pleased to say that three courts of appeals have since agreed with me that this was unconstitutional, and now this case is being decided by the United States Supreme Court this term. And I hope and expect the court will agree with what the three circuits have done with it so far. But we can't let this go. We can't allow it to continue. We can't continue to ignore constitutional violations and say, well, we will let the courts respond. We'll let the courts iron it out. As the D.C. Circuit put it in its opinion, ruling these appointments unconstitutional, allowing the president to define the scope of his own appointments power would eviscerate the Constitution's separation of powers. The court added an interpretation of the recess in the recess appointments clause that permits the president to take permits the president to decide when the Senate is in recess would demolish the checks and balances inherent in the advice and consent requirement, giving the president free rein to appoint his desired nominees, including, I might add, judicial nominees, anytime he pleases. This cannot be the law. So, sadly, far from making clear to the president that he should fear a response not only from the judiciary for his violation of constitutional restraints, but also from the Senate, we've given the president basically what he wanted. We've confirmed members to the NLRB. Some of them were different members, but they were, some would say, fungible. And despite the fact that on February 1st, 2013, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and 42 other Republicans, including myself, sent a letter to the president stating that we have serious concerns about the lack of congressional oversight of the CFPB and the lack of normal democratic checks on its sole director. And on that basis, we were unwilling, absent significant reforms, to confirm anyone to that position, to the head of the CFPB. On July 16, 2013, just a few months later, the Senate approved Richard Cordray by a vote of 66 to 34. Now, for those of you still trying to do the math, yes, that included a whole lot of Republicans voting with Democrats to confirm Richard Cordray to that position. Had we been unified, we could have taken a number of actions to make clear to President Obama that his flagrantly unconstitutional recess appointments would not be tolerated. We could have halted confirmations of nominees or halted consideration of presidentially supported legislation altogether. It wouldn't really matter the specifics, so long as we sent the unequivocal message to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and made the president face real consequences for his unconstitutional actions. We must get more members of Congress thinking about their duty to interpret the Constitution, thinking about the fact that they have a role to play when it comes to textualism, thinking about the fact that they are independent constitutional officers who have themselves taken an oath to uphold and protect and defend the Constitution. Until we do so, in my view, we will continue to rely far too much on the courts, and in so doing, surrender to the Article III branch of government far too much of our government. I continue to believe that our best days as Americans remain yet ahead of us. They remain ahead of us because, fortunately, thanks to fantastic organizations like the Federalist Society, Americans are talking about the Constitution again. They're talking again about civics. They're talking again about the risks associated with the excessive accumulation of power. Together, as we advance this discussion, as we continue this dialogue, not just among our wonky Federalist Society lawyer friends, but among our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, our crazy aunts and uncles, we can re-inject the Constitution back into American political discourse. And as that happens, I think we can restore the greatness of our great republic. Thank you very much.
We started about 5 minutes late, so we have time for a couple of quick questions. Please make sure they are short, and please make sure there's a question mark at the end of the sentence.
Senator, just touching upon your comments regarding the Senate's duty to consider constitutionality of what happens there, I'm wondering if you, and this is a little bit unrelated to your substantive point, but I'm wondering whether you have any views on the ENDA legislation that was just considered by the Senate, and in particular the power of Congress, enumerated power, to do that type of legislation.
To
be able to pass discrimination. I know the civil rights, there was that substantial effects doctrine and stuff like that, but I think with regard to ENDA and especially some of the classes that are defined, especially with regard to the gender identity issue, I'm not sure you can make a substantial effects argument because it's such a small percentage of the population, and I'm not sure the aggregation theory works.
Yeah. Well, of course, with the aggregation theory, anything satisfies the substantial effects test. I mean, literally anything. Now, we found something last summer that didn't, and yet last summer they created a new way around it, and so even that didn't end up mattering. But yeah, notwithstanding the fact that we're dealing with a small percentage of the population, I don't think that would impact what the court would do with the substantial effects test there, because everything affects everything else. Just as the migration of monarch butterflies in South America can impact weather in Florida, everything here affects everything else. And so I think the Supreme Court would end up upholding something like that against a Commerce Clause challenge.
Senator, I'm Ralph Cote, attorney from New York. My question for you is, what do you make of the fact that the other branch of our democratic government, the electorate, by a fair margin managed to re-elect the president and his U.S. Senate? Doesn't it form some kind of ratification of his prior bad and unconstitutional behavior?
No.
Why not? And why not?
No. Look, absolutely not. We can say a lot about the fact that he was reelected. We can say a lot about the fact that the American people reelected a United States Senate still under the control of the president's party. But one of the things that we may not safely say is that that somehow constitutionally ratifies or blesses the unconstitutional actions of this administration, those taken either prior to the November 2012 election or those that have been taken since the November 2012 election. I think it does say a lot of things, and I think one of the many things that it says is that there are tremendous blessings, let's just say, that come with incumbency. It is kind of analogous to one of Newton's laws of motion. He who is in power shall remain in power unless acted upon with overwhelming force. I think that's what it says more than anything else, but it certainly does not tell us that their actions are constitutional when they, in many instances, are quite patently not.
Last question to your right.
Senator, speaking of the D.C. Circuit nominees, I was wondering what your thoughts are in terms of the Democrats' willingness to blow up the filibuster. I certainly share a lot of your same concerns about the administration openly trying to essentially stack the D.C. Circuit, but do you think there's more to be lost in potentially losing the filibuster than is to be gained by resisting these nominees?
No, I don't, because I don't think the Democrats would do that. Now, not all of my Republican colleagues agree with me on this point, but I don't think the Democrats in the Senate are willing to quote-unquote go nuclear. I really need to find a better I'm determined to find a better shorthand description of that process, you know, the process by which they blow up the filibuster rule there. As you may have seen earlier this year during the summer, there was a threat that they made to go nuclear with regard to some of the president's executive branch nominations, that if we didn't confirm them, that they would go nuclear. I didn't believe them. I still don't believe that they had the ability to carry out that threat. I don't think they would have had enough votes to carry out that threat. There are certainly some Democratic senators who would have. I don't think they would have gotten enough of them to go in that direction, in part because there is an element, I guess one reason why people use the term nuclear option is that there is a mutually assured destruction aspect of this that's very real. And so I don't think they would have gone there with executive nominations. And I really don't think they'll go there with respect to judicial nominations.